This is a Harper Guys production.
The following will contain adult subject matter and may not be suitable for all audiences.
Could lightning really strike the same place twice?
Welcome to the gallows.
This is Jake. With me as always, my co-host Adam.
Yo.
And tonight we are going to get you started off with our PSA.
PSA time. Visit us at thegallowspodcast.com. From there you can go to our Facebook, Twitter, and Patreon. Check out our Patreon website and find our missing episodes.
That's right.
That is the website for the Patreon is www.patreon.com/Harper Guys Production. You can also visit us everywhere podcasts are found. If you have any questions, comments, or case ideas, please email us at thegallowspod@gmail.com, and we are getting ready to embark on episode 33.
Episode 33. Thank you very much. A little bit about what's going on in the world of death penalty cases right now. So, in between the last show and this one, we actually had Keith Dwayne Nelson, one of the federal inmates that was actually put to death. Looked like they were going to get to stay for a minute. And they put a slight pause on it. They didn't actually go full on stay, and they were like, we're good. And they went ahead and finished him off. So
lit him up.
Yeah, Keith Dwayne is gone. So the next two upcoming that we have are more feds. That's William LaCroix on the 22nd, which is just a couple weeks from now. 2 days later, which seems to be their timeline that they like, we got Christopher Villalba. He is also fed. And then we have Carlos Trevino out of Texas, who is going to be on 9/30. From there, we have nothing in October, nothing in November, and the one in Tennessee in December, which we'll get more into that a little bit later.
Wait, what happened to Ruben?
Ruben Gutierrez, he's gone. Ruben was put away a while back. I think you're getting confused on who your people are.
The screwdriver killer?
Yeah, dude.
I thought he was September.
I don't believe so. Now I'm going to have to go back and look, but I'm pretty sure Ruben got his.
Uh-uh.
Well.
Unless they recanted and brought him back.
We'll have to go back and look at it. I'm pretty sure that we reported already that Ruben was passed, but I've been wrong before.
I would have celebrated.
I will update Ruben on the next show.
I would have had some celebration music.
Yes. Also important to know, super annoying, is just like John Kasich before him, Mike DeWine, who, yes, we are based out of Ohio, but Ohio is the most active when it comes to things that they do that are involving the death penalty. He is giving reprieves right now. So a reprieve isn't like clemency or a commuted sentence or anything like that. A reprieve is just like, we'll let you know when we're going to get you. It's going to be a while, but we'll let you know, to where it basically takes the date off the table. And that is partially, I think, because they are clear out to 2023 with a bunch of their scheduled executions. If you go to deathrowpenalty.org or deathrowinformation.org, it will give you a list of the things that are upcoming. I do a little bit more research from there, just kind of get a feel for who the people are and what the cases are. But it is incredible the number of people that Ohio actually has on that list. And the only other people that have anything scheduled in the next year are Texas. I mean, so that tells you how insane this entire thing is.
Texas is just overbooked.
Right.
Ohio's just making bad decisions.
Right. One is being prepared, The other one is procrastinating, is yeah. what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, come on. Jesus.
So it's kind of annoying on that aspect. We don't think that the death penalty is always warranted in every case. If you have cases in your state where it's warranted and that is what gets passed down, I feel it's the state's obligation to follow through with the will of the people instead of sitting on their hands for a number of reasons. We've proven that there are a couple different drugs out there that work right now without having any of the things that make them to where they can be sued, right?
If they don't like the drugs, a plastic bag works good too.
Right. I'm just saying.
Over the head.
But phenobarbital does it all. Like, it's the one-shot wonder, right? So I hope that they get it figured out pretty soon and they actually start carrying this stuff out. I have a feeling that DeWine is going to keep pushing them out until he's out of office. That's what my estimation would be. I've been wrong before, but we'll see how it goes.
You think he's going to get reelected?
I think he'll get reelected in a landslide.
Really? People think he's been great, huh?
Yes, people have loved that guy. So for tonight's story, I will warn you ahead of time that there's some pretty graphic stuff in this. If you are easily turned, then this might not quite be the episode for you. We keep it real. We keep it raw to make sure that you get an exact sense of exactly what is going on. So that's just a little precursor as we get into it. So this brings us to December the 11th of 1974. A woman named Barbara Hendrickson was actually enjoying the late afternoon sun with her husband Don on their front porch. They had three children, and all three kids are outside playing at the time out back, and it was unseasonably warm that day. It was 60 degrees in December in Clearview, Washington. As the sun warms their faces, they just kind of sit out there together, hanging out, enjoying, you know, a little bit of a respite before the winter kicks back in. And while they're sitting there, Barbara actually has her eyes closed, and she hears something, and it's actually somebody shuffling up the driveway. It's like, so she opens her eyes to kind of see what's going on, and she sees her neighbor Renee is kind of scurrying up the driveway real quick, and she can see that she has her 8-month-old daughter Savannah in her arms. As she gets closer, Barbara can see that she's absolutely in tears at this point in time. So Barbara, being the good neighbor that she is, they're very close friends, she jumps up and she grabs Savannah, and she has Don help Renee into the house at the time. At this point in time, Renee starts to panic. She is just absolutely overcome with fear, and Don, the husband in this situation, he knew that something was wrong. So while he gets his wife settled in, you know, to try to help her and see what she can do, he calls the sheriff's office immediately. You know, like, there's no way that this girl's this shook up if nothing had happened, right? So the sheriff arrives, and Renee decides, you know, I'm going to go ahead and tell my whole story. So much like the Hendricksons, Renee had actually been enjoying the warm sun herself, right? And she decided it was the perfect day to go ahead and wash some windows. She had her daughter Savannah actually laying on a blanket out in the yard, you know, to where that sounds kind of crazy to me, but given the time period, I don't think that that's weird, you know? Set your baby there for a few minutes. They enjoy being outside too. It's not like she's being neglectful about the whole thing.
Right.
Right? So she's got her laying just a few feet away, and she was notorious for humming while she cleaned. She loved being able to clean and actually feeling like she was getting something out of it. You know what I mean? Like, and I think there's a lot of people that actually enjoy their cleaning these days. So while she's doing this, she catches a little glimpse out of her eye, and she sees a guy that's actually walking down the driveway. So she turns, and he kind of like looks at her kind of surprised, like, hey, like, what the heck? And he just turns around and walks right back down their driveway. Well, Renee figured it was somebody that was lost and that they had actually just found the wrong house on accident. You know, her house actually sat about a quarter mile back off the road. So if somebody was looking for another one of the long lanes, which are apparently very common in Clearview, this could have happened. So sure. She goes back to what she's doing, you know, like it was no big deal, you know, things like that happen all the time. He just left. A few minutes later, she hears these footsteps again, but this time they're literally running up the driveway and like making a beeline for her. So she scoops up her daughter. She goes into the house, literally makes it. It's like, sounds like a scene out of a movie. You know, one step in front of this guy, gets the door closed. Well, this guy shoulders in the door, and Renee finds herself in this moment. She's face to face with this absolute monster. He pulls a knife off of his hip and he holds it to her infant daughter's throat. I mean, that's gotta be terrifying with an 8-month-old, right?
Yes.
So Renee decides in this moment, it's up to me and only me to make sure that I keep my daughter safe. Whatever happens, I'm going to keep my daughter safe. Her husband, Jack, was actually out of town at the time on business. But in a one stoplight town, you know, this kind of thing isn't super, people don't expect this kind of thing to be happening all the time.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? Well, with him being gone and her in a little tiny nowhere town that doesn't even have their own cop, they rely on the county sheriff's department. She knows that she's on an island. No one's coming to help. You know, the odds of somebody even hearing her scream from her house are probably incredibly low. So she very calmly looks at him and she says, "Is there anything I can do for you?" Immediately, he's still holding the knife toward the baby. He says, "You know what? You can. Go ahead and get naked and then sit down in that recliner." So petrified at this point in time, she's like, "I'm going to do whatever I need to do to take care of me and my baby."
Survival mode.
That's right. So she lays Savannah on the floor at this point in time. She does as she's told, and this monster comes and stands right in front of her with the knife still, like, dangling in his hand above her daughter that's laying on the floor. And she said that she was afraid that he was going to rape her. He did, but not in the conventional way. Instead, he decided that he was going to unzip his pants, and he looked at her and he just said, "You know what I want." So determined to keep her child safe, she complies with the oral sex demand. Once the act's over, he leans down and he just whispers, "Thanks." And then he walks out of the door like nothing had happened. I mean, the creepy level on that, I couldn't even imagine. You know, somebody whispering thanks for that, you know, after you've been sodomized. Well, once he's gone, that's when she runs over to the Hendrickson's house. She describes this hulking man as unkempt with brown hair that had actually, like, turned red out on the ends. Said he couldn't have been more than 20, 21 years old. And the sheriff says, "You know, thanks for giving us all this information. You know, do you want to go to the hospital first to get checked out?" And she says, "No." She said, "Let's just go to the station, get this knocked out." So she kind of is still decides she's going to keep herself together, you know? So they get down to the station quickly, gives her statement over the whole thing. And the police were like, "Okay, here's a lineup." Immediately, she picks it out. She's like, "That's absolutely him. No questions asked. It's a guy named Charles Campbell." Well, before they met on that day in 1974, Renee and Charles could not have had more different lives. Renee was one of those girls. She came from Jamestown, North Dakota, where she was in the band. She grew up in a very close-knit family. After high school, she was one of those Midwestern or slightly Western kids, you know, that basically had to get out of the small place that they'd always been trapped in their whole life. So after graduation, she packs up and she heads for California to go follow her dreams. Well, eventually she's out there for a couple months, not really finding exactly what she wants to do. So she starts working her way up the coast, and this is where she lands in Clearview, Washington. At this point in time, she's still only 19 years old, right? Well, she meets a 33-year-old there that is divorced and has a couple kids, and this would end up being Jack. He had just gotten out of a 10-year marriage and was actually looking to start his life all over. He quickly fell for Renee, even though he wasn't looking for a relationship at all, and they would actually be married just a couple years later in 1972. So they're renting for a little while. In 1973, they purchase the home in Clearview, which is going to be their house, and Renee gets pregnant, right? So life is going well for Renee. I mean, the only thing that she hated was that Jack traveled and she missed him when he traveled, right? On the other side, for Charles, things were a little bit more tumultuous. He was born in 1954 in Hawaii. He was an army brat. You know, one of these kids that gets bounced from place to place as they go. They ended up moving to Sonoma, Washington, which is where his dad would get stationed at later. And his dad was an incredibly abusive drunk. He was really well liked in the service, you know, known as a man of honor. At home, beating the shit out of his kids and his wife was a Tuesday night. You know, like, he was just one of those people. Well, strangely enough, Charles thought that it was, like, admirable that this guy's teaching his family how to be tough. And he thought his dad was a hero, and he thought his mom was actually quite weak because she put up with being treated that way. And, you know, he thought that she should stand up for herself no matter what kind of beating that she got, you know, to set a better example for her children, to where he despised his mother his entire life for that, according to him. So what does this lead to when you have abusive parents? Of course, he gets into drugs and alcohol, and he starts fighting, right? He had a juvie record before he even entered sixth grade. Like, you got to earn that.
Before sixth grade?
Yeah, like, you got juvie on you at the age of 12.
I was going to say, sixth grade's like 11 or 12.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Well, he didn't dick around. At the age of 16, a couple years later, he gets his first Grand Theft Auto.
Of course.
Right? So he does a little more time in juvie for that one. Gets out shortly before he's 18. And then at 18, he ends up going to prison. He gets busted in a prostitution ring. Now, he wasn't just busted, and there was a lot of different things that went into it. Before it was all said and done, they found out that he had a couple guns that he wasn't allowed to own because of some of the trouble that he had been in before. So he had a violation of the Federal Arms Act. When they went to arrest him, he resisted arrest. Criminal trespass for breaking into a house. Burglary for breaking into the same house. Two counts of grand larceny for basically trying to filter money in and out and try to work through this whole prostitution ring. Carrying a concealed weapon, which you can't do. And second degree assault, which was part of what actually started the whole incident when he got in trouble anyway. He gets sentenced to 30 years for this.
Yikes.
I mean, that's a laundry list of problems, and putting an 18-year-old away for 30 years, that's a long time. Well, while he's in, several mistakes are discovered as they start going through his appeals process, and some of them were so blatant that they actually came back and they cut a deal with him after he was already in jail, supposed to be serving 30 years without the opportunity of parole. After 8 months, he's released, less than 1 year, with the rest of it being a suspended sentence as long as he followed all of his guidelines. That's crazy. 8 months out of a 30-year sentence.
Yeah, that's a little bit ridiculous.
So when he gets out, he's all alone. The young wife that he had married before he had gotten in trouble, he had actually married a woman that was 4 years older than him and had a baby. She didn't want anything to do with him, right? So he's like, all right, I'm going to go ahead and try to do me on my own. Another precondition of his release was that he had to go to counseling, you know?
Makes sense.
Try to get him squared away. You know, to the normal person, it would make sense. To him, it was an opportunity. Within a couple weeks, he actually seduced the counselor and within 6 weeks had her pregnant.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So this guy definitely has some con man built into him along with everything else. And at 6'5", 245 pounds, he's a giant human being, right? Well, 2 months later, after he finds out that he has her pregnant, is when he shows up and commits that heinous crime against Renee, right? So Charles gets charged with the rape instantaneously, sodomy, assault with intention to kill, kidnapping, assault with a deadly weapon. That's a pretty good laundry list again. So this guy's got two laundry lists in basically a year.
He's thinking, oh, another 30 years and I'll only do 8 months.
Right. He denied ever being there, but there were several witnesses that saw him in the area, and there were actually two people that could clearly identify him that saw him walking up that driveway because they had known Jack to where they could place him at the scene very easily. He claimed that he had been at work that day in the neighboring town about 25 miles away of Renton. Well, police do their due diligence and find out that this guy, he had actually quit the day before the rape took place, and $1,200 was missing from the pizza joint.
Hmm.
I'm sure that's a pure coincidence.
Completely.
Right. So you would think that this would be super easy, right? Well, it actually took them 2 years to find him after the initial arrest. He jumps bail and he just disappears to where they're looking all over the place for this guy. You know?
Ain't like he's no small fry. Come on.
I mean, right? So of all things, he was picked up for a drunken disorderly near Renton. So for 2 years, he's 25 miles away, right? Well, one of the sheriffs that was actually involved in that, because the sheriffs really kind of run the county up there. You know, not every town has their own local police department to where these guys come in, they kind of take care of most things, right? So he, as soon as he saw him, he's like, oh yeah, this is definitely the guy we've been searching for 2 years. Calls up Renee. Renee comes down. They put together a lineup. Bam. 2 seconds. Has him picked out just like that. No questions asked. So in a an entire two-day trial for the rape, intent to murder, all of those things, he gets 45 years in prison, right?
Well, rape's a serious thing, man.
It's true. Well, much like their youth, their lives from this point obviously start going in different directions. Renee's marriage begins to just absolutely fall apart, and her and Jack actually split a year later in 1975. Ironically, though, the two actually remained really, really close friends, but the rape created a divide that just really couldn't be closed between the two of them. They decided they would co-parent together, and this seemed to work out really, really well for their daughter, Shanna. And Renee even got to spend all the holidays and family get-togethers with Jack and his family. Now, again, that sounds kind of weird to me after you divorce somebody, right? No. His family still absolutely loved Renee, thought that she was fantastic, you know, understood that she had been through a terrible tragedy, you know, that most people shouldn't have to go through, and they clearly loved their granddaughter. You know, they wanted to have her around all the time.
Sure.
To where they talked about how easy it was all the time. You know, like she was always cooking and bringing stuff over, and they would swap recipes, and families are disjointed, and weird things happen, and they get glued together and pieced back together in strange ways. For her, she found what was working, right? Well,
it's one of those situations where they want the granddaughter around.
Yes, absolutely.
And the ex of their son isn't the worst person in the world. Had some bad shit happen to her.
Yeah.
So why not?
Right. And the son doesn't hate her either.
Right. Exactly. So in those situations, there's going to be some accommodations.
I think so. It's not like it was some brutal breakup. So it's also around this time, you know, as things are starting to come back together, that she found her calling. She actually began selling beauty products from her home by catalog, you know, having little parties, getting people to start getting into the stuff. And she was 5'9", had high cheekbones, long brown hair, and had the perfect model shape. So it was really easy to take beauty advice from her. Well, one of the ladies that was buying from her actually ran a beauty school. And she's like, hey, how would you like to come on and be a recruiter? She's like, people are going to love you, your personality, your build, you know, your knowledge of how to use those products. Like, we absolutely would love it if you would come work for us, you know, and we're going to pay you a commission on every person that you get to get signed up. She's 100% on board. She's like, that sounds fantastic. I can make money on more than one front, keep providing for me and my daughter. Things are great. So she decides to stay in Clearview and keep building her life. And her rationale for the entire thing, well, was that the monster that had pulled this on her was serving a 40-year sentence and a 35-year sentence. So that's a 75-year sentence. I mean, by the time the 75 years is up, she's going to be in her 90s.
He's going to be dust.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. Well, in a weird event that can only be described as this, Jack was at his apartment. So this is her now ex-husband, right? And this is in 1977. And he gets a knock on the door where he sees a man that he's never seen before through the peephole, but he's got a present in his hands. And the guy, he welcomes in and he asks him who he is, and he sets the package on the floor. And when Jack turns, he actually clocks him straight from behind. Jack wakes up and he's tied to a chair. And the guy goes outside, comes back with a gas can, covers him in gas, lights him on fire, casually walks out with the present. Jack would go on to say that he had never seen this guy before. It appears
he survived.
Survives.
And
it appears to be a completely random attack. There would actually be four other attacks in the Pacific Northwest over a 3-year period before they abruptly ended. So 1980 was the last one, and then there was never another one after that.
The gas can attempted murderer?
Yes. And it actually...
How many did he murder?
The other three.
Oh, my God.
So Jackson...
How do you survive that?
I don't know.
Dude's scarred for life, guaranteed.
80% of his body.
Good God.
Burnt. So, but over the coming months, they actually had him fitted with a special rubber suit. His family obviously comes from some means at this point, and he's doing very well for himself. They get a special rubberized suit that's made for him to help his healing process. And he actually begins to start to get his strength back. He begins driving again in March of 1978. But in April, just 1 month later, he leaves his mom and dad's at a get-together that everybody was at, and his truck goes off of the road and hits a tree. And he's killed in the accident. So he survives being lit on fire. 6 months later, he dies in a truck accident.
Jesus. How ironic, though, that even though they're an estranged couple, that two horrible incidents happened to each one of these people.
Right. Well, the other thing, too, and this is not throwing... I'm not throwing dirt on anybody that's been passed away. I'm just telling you what I have found through all of the research on this. It was ruled an accident, but there were people that were at that party that said that he was very, very heavy, like on the goodbye at that point, and that he was a man that, while he loved his family, was known to have some vanity to him, to where they felt like as things went on and he realized that these burns weren't ever going to go away, people wondered if that tree was an option, not an accident, you know? Mm-hmm. Either way, though,
you undo the seatbelt and floor it? Yeah.
Yeah. So, but either way, it was ruled an accident, and I hope that was absolutely the case, right? Well, Renee was crushed, you know, at this point. So now she's got to deal with explaining this entire thing to her daughter, you know, A, what happened to him 6 months ago.
The father of the child.
Right, and now the fact that her dad's not coming back, you know? So, absolutely full plate for her, right? Well, at the same time that all of this is going on, Charles actually adapts really quick once he's back in prison. His stature, you know, just as big as he is, it really gives him a reputation in there. And the fact that he knocks out several inmates with one punch leads to the nickname of they just called him One Punch. And people were petrified of this guy, even in prison. If you have a bunch of prisoners that are afraid of you, you're a pretty bad mofo.
Yeah.
You know?
What a jackass.
Right. So he quickly ends up finding himself working for this crooked counselor. All right. So this guy's name is Bill Button. All right. And I'm just going to say it again because everything I did some homework before I decided whether or not I was going to elaborate on this guy at all. This guy is a turd. All right.
So who is he again?
So his name is Bill Button, and he's actually the head counselor at the prison.
Can I say it once?
Yeah.
Bill Button.
Bill Button. Just sounds like a douche. If you're another Bill Button out there listening, though, I do apologize.
Doucher.
Right. So Button, at the time, is actually running drugs, prostitution, and money laundering in the prison, right? It's like Andy Dufresne stuff, you know?
My God, man.
So what he does is he assembles a crew of actual inmates, you know, one of which is obviously Charles, and he pays them in drugs, prostitutes, and money.
Yes.
Ironic, isn't it?
If you're the inmates, that's good money.
Yeah. Charles was known as one of the best drug movers for him in the entire prison because he was so big that most of the guards didn't give him a thorough pat down to where he was able to really move.
He keeps his shit up on top of his shoulders.
Right.
They can't reach it.
Right. He moves pretty free throughout the prison, really, all things considered. And he was also known to be in one of the guys that was at the right hand to where he would carry out attacks on other inmates. So if somebody owed Button money, you know, you can't pay me, you're going to catch a beating until you can pay me. Other people that were working in those trades, moving drugs, you know, prostituting out other prisoners, they would catch beatings, you know, to where he became really, really highly in favor of Button.
Old jackass One Punch.
Yep. Well, Button, like I said, he's the one who gives all the recommendations to the parole board, and he also makes recommendations to the warden, you know, to where when there's different things that should be done. So in 1980, he actually gets Charles into a work release program, and in January of 1982, he was able to get him released from prison and designated to a halfway house.
After how many years?
So let me get there. Charles has 45 and 30-year sentences, right? Which most people thought added up to 75. It does, but not in prison math. Those numbers actually run concurrently, so at the same time. So that puts the maximum at 45. Here's the weird trigger. Because the 30-year sentence was imposed first, the statutes and limitations that go with that, because it's not a capital murder case, which is the only thing that actually overrides this, eligible for parole in less than 6 years. So they let him out for a 30-year sentence in 8 months and then a 45-year sentence in under 6 years. Unbelievable to me. Less than 7 years out of 75.
He's got 70 years worth of sentencing, and he spends no more than 7 whole years in jail.
Yes. It's actually less than. It's like 6.5. It's ridiculous. So once he's out, he goes back to doing what he's always done. He starts womenizing, finds some women that he has known, finds some new women, just kind of starts bouncing around. Is in trouble several times for being late to the halfway house, but wasn't in that much trouble for it because who are they going to tell? Button. You know what I mean? Like, what's going to happen at that point? Well,
and I'm sure he's still working for Button, doing some things.
Sure. Well, and he easily falls right back into a life of drugs and alcohol. I mean, literally, it's a daily thing. Whatever he can get his hands on, here we go. So this brings us to April the 14th, 1982. It's about noon, and Renee is home, and she's working on an order for the beauty supplies, right? To where a bunch of women had ordered some stuff, so she's trying to get everything done and sent out. That way, it comes in, she gets paid, right? Next thing you know, she hears a door open, looks up, and Charles is once again in her home. She tries to run for the back door, and he quickly reaches out to her, and in this moment, One Punch lives up to his name. Drops her. One shot. He drags her into the bedroom where he mercilessly beats her, slices her throat, and then rapes her post-mortem. A couple of hours later, after he's already executed Renee, Shanna gets off the bus, where she's greeted every day by Barbara. This was customary, as Barbara loved to get to see her every day, and all of her kids were already grown now and out of the house. You know, she's in her mid-40s, you know, getting into late 40s at this point in time. And Deborah said, hey, you know, just so that you know, I'll be over in just a little bit. I'm going to help your mom with the Jell-O tonight. So I'll probably be over somewhere around, let's go with 3 o'clock. She said, okay, we'll see you then. Well, Shanna turns and heads up to the house like nothing. It's a regular day for her. So she gets into the house and she's grabbed by Charles immediately. And he takes her by the hand and he walks her back to the same bedroom and makes her stare at her mother's body. While she's standing there, he reaches around and slices her throat, literally to the point where it just about severs her head. And within a few seconds, she's gone. At about 3:15, that's when Barbara arrives. So she's a few minutes late. She walks in and she sees everything strewn about the table and she yells for Renee and she doesn't hear come anything. So she turns and she looks down the hallway because she knows that her bedroom's down there. And next thing you know, she sees Charles standing there with a bloody knife. So she doesn't really know what to do. So she looks, there's an end table that's to her left. She grabs the end table and flips it over. So it's right in between them, right? And she starts bolting it for the front door. Charles, being as big as he was, he jumps right over the table as it's laying on the floor and he grabs Deborah. They struggle and they start to head down the hallway just a little ways. And finally, at one point, he's able to get a clean shot in on her and drops her. While she's on the ground, face down, he puts his knee in the middle of her back, grabs her by her hair, pulls her head back, and slices her throat all the way too. He gets up, kind of looks around for a second, and then walks right out the door and right back down the same driveway again like nothing had happened. Now, I can't find anything that talks about whether or not he was covered in blood at this point, but you would have to believe after brutally murdering three people like this that he would be.
I would agree.
Well, there's no record of it, so I'm not really sure if that's the case.
You can only imagine.
Yes. So he's headed back to the halfway house at this point in time, right? Well, he arrives, and he's actually late. Well, what he doesn't realize is the guy that's there is one of the guys that runs all of the halfway houses for the state. He's doing a bed check and making sure that everything's on the up and up. So Button has no authority over a guy like this.
Whoops.
Yeah. So they make him take a breathalyzer, right? His breathalyzer comes out to be a 0.29. I don't know if you know that. Do you know what that means, a 0.29 on a breathalyzer?
Isn't like 0.08 is like legally drunk now?
0.08 is legally drunk. 0.29 actually means that your blood level is 29% alcohol.
Nice.
I mean, that's like death stuff right there. There's people that end up in the hospital in like near death with anything that's over 25. I mean, that's a level of, I don't know if I've ever been a 0.29, and this guy was absolutely crazy, right? So they grab him and they take him back to the Monroe prison, which is where he had actually been held prior to that. At the same time, Don, the husband of Barbara, is sitting at home and he's like, you know, where has she gotten off to? So he's like, you know, I haven't seen Renee in a little while. So he gets up and heads across the street and he gets over and he opens the door. First thing he sees is his wife laying there on the floor. So he runs over to her, gets down on the floor. He knows that she's gone immediately. He said at this point he couldn't even yell for Renee because he was so paralyzed by the silence of the house because everything was so dead quiet that he wasn't sure if somebody else was still in there or what exactly was going on. But he makes his way, checking all the rooms. He gets back to the back bedroom and finds the two of them just laying there. And at this point, he goes back out, heads back over to his house, and calls 911 at that point in time. I don't know how you make that call. I mean, that's got to be just absolutely gut-wrenching the whole way down.
It's horrible.
Right. Well, the officers get there, and they see what's happened. They call the FBI right away. So within an hour, you have a couple FBI officials and local detectives that are on it right away. Well, one of the officers that's actually at the scene is talking with the investigators, and he says, you know, with this being a knife like this, he's like, I cannot help but make this connection between here in 1974, you know, with this guy Charles. So they perked up immediately, right? Well, what they come to find out is after Charles was out, that he had actually been terrorizing his ex-wife prior to this happening, you know, and she kept quiet for the 6 months after he'd been out because she didn't want to end up on the wrong end of him. Well, then she sees the murders on TV. She calls the police immediately and says, yes, he raped me multiple times and talked about killing Renee. So now they actually have something that can tie him to this, right? So they know they got Charles in custody right now. He's not going anywhere after what had happened. So they wait for the evidence to come back, and they find hair, fingerprints, and what they believe is his saliva at the scene, and they're all matches for him. So within 2 days, he's brought up on 3 counts of capital murder.
Guess what, Lucy? You got some explaining to do.
Well, that's one of the things we'll get to later that's very strange about the lack of explaining that happens in this case. So the trial moves very, very quickly. This is exactly 5 days for the jury to convict him on all 3 counts.
How many days?
5.
Seems like a lot.
Well, when it's cut and dry, it's cut and dry. You got witnesses, and the defense did not even call a single witness or raise one objection during the trial. Thought that was odd.
Amen.
Yeah. Hey.
Ship his ass off.
It is what it is, right? Another thing that happened is after the trial was over, he would never say another word about the crimes. If anybody asked him about it, he wouldn't say a word about it. He turned down every basically major news outlet known that wanted to interview this guy. Any amount of money, didn't want nothing to do with it. He maintained his innocence, and he said that, yeah, there's evidence against me, and I don't care. Well, they also had the alibi that he gave. He said that he was at his girlfriend's house drinking. Well, he wasn't at his girlfriend's house drinking, because he said that he had started drinking early in the morning, passed out there, slept there all day, and that's why he was so late getting back. She said, no, that's not the case. He was here, but it wasn't until 8 o'clock at night. He was here for about 5 hours, and I kicked him out. And that's when he had to head back, and that's when he got caught. Well, his counsel started arguing things like cruel and unusual punishment, and the courts were like, no. And they said, well, it's cruel and unusual punishment to hang somebody. Well, the court comes back and says, even if we agree with you, we've given him the option of lethal injection. So at this point, if you truly believe that, you can have him change what he's willing to go through, and we are happy to go ahead and do some injecting here on him and call it a day. Well, he says that he will not make a decision that would contribute to his death. We've heard this one before. So, the hanging stands. After 12 years of appeals within the state, they're like, you know what? We're ready for execution. So, Charles is slated at that time to only be the 4th inmate to die in Washington State since 1976 when it came back. That's crazy. What is even crazier, though, is he's going to be the 2nd hanging from them. Right?
I thought I heard you right the first time.
Yes.
Hanging?
Hanging.
Oh, the gallows.
That's right. So, small little tidbit here is hanging actually was not taken off the books there until 1992 because the sentencing was before then. He gets it. It's kind of crazy if you ask me.
Hashtag a fan.
Another interesting thing.
When you deserve it.
Right? So the federal penitentiary in Washington is in Walla Walla, right? And the gallows room is what's built there. Instead of having gallows outside because of the amount of weather that they get there, they knew that it wouldn't hold up. So they actually had a room built inside the prison specifically for having hanging executions. It was used for the first time in 1935, and it was used continually as the only means of execution until they outlawed the executions countrywide back in the 50s. I mean, back in the 60s. So to me, that's crazy. Like, nah, that's cool. We got this. The chair, we don't need your chair. Gas chamber, meh, we're good on that too. We're just going to keep doing it our way.
You know what? This is the cheapest. The only investment is a rope. The thing's been built for 40 years.
Yeah.
We're good.
Yeah. The other crazy part here is the only other guy that they actually hung was a guy named Wesley Dodd. This piece of work murdered 3 young boys. So they definitely were like, yeah, that's good. It actually turns out that as of now to date, he was number 4. Number 5 was the last one in 2011, and they haven't executed anybody since in the state. Another one of those states that has it, but they're just not using it. It's a pretty liberal area to where that's what's happening.
You got to use it or lose it.
That's right. So this brings us up to the execution on May the 27th of 1994. So Governor Mike Lowry, who at the time was actually trying to end capital punishment in the state of Washington, refused to hear his plea for clemency. What's that tell you? This guy's trying to get rid of this, but he won't hear what you have to say about it because you're such a monster, right?
Yeah, big time.
So Charles ends up meeting with his former counselor and his daughter for a few hours in the afternoon. So how this lady is still having anything to do with him is insane to me. this is the counselor that he swindled or seduced or however you want to put it into getting together with him, had a baby. You know what I mean? How do you want to go see your dad if you're that child?
But it's daddy.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
He was served an undisclosed meal at 7 p.m., which I thought was odd that they basically said that it's his private business and his last couple hours, you know, to give him some dignity.
Whose private business?
Right. I was like, that should be public information, right?
So, in other words, it was steak and potatoes.
Steak and potatoes. So, at 9 p.m., it's time for him to go to the execution chamber. Charles, sitting in his shell, just refuses to comply. And they end up having to tase him and use 11 guards to get him safely into the room. So, as...
he was going out fighting.
Oh, yeah. So, the door opens, and they bring him in, and he still is not cooperating.
Well, I mean, when you think about it, they're not going to put him on a bed. They're not going to hook him up with needles. Mm-hmm. They're going to string him up.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're as big as that dude, why not go down swinging?
Yeah. I don't disagree. Well, as they come in and as they try to do their work, witnesses are like literally gasping at what is going on. You know, he's thrashing around, fighting everybody. So they end up tying him to a board, which actually was standard practice with any gallows for forever. If somebody wouldn't be noncompliant, all right, we got the board. Get the board.
Guess what? Your head is still accessible.
That's correct. So after they get him onto the board, it took officers over 90 seconds to get the hood on because he was trying to bite them. So they actually had to subdue his head. Finally, they get everything in place. The death sentence gets read by the warden. Charles is asked if he has any final words. He says nothing. Not no, not nothing. The warden said, okay. Gives a nod. The gallows let loose. Charles drops and literally on the bounce, just on cue like it's supposed to, the curtain comes down. So you don't get to just sit there and watch the dangle and the shaking. Like, that's all said and done at
that point.
That's
the best part.
But what had to be so eerie, so they said complete silence in the observation chamber, right? About a minute later, a voice comes over the intercom and it says, time of death, 10:03. To me, I can just imagine that had to be like a Willy's kind of moment. You know what I mean? Like, whoa. You know what I mean? Like, nobody's talking and then this voice comes over and that's what they say. It's actually remarked after the execution by one of the guards that he could not believe how quickly Charles died. That he had had friends that had been parts of other executions, that he had talked to some people ahead of time to be, you know, kind of prepared for what he was getting into. And he just was absolutely shocked at how fast this whole thing had gone.
I know why.
Because exactly,
I know where you're going.
Exactly 3 days after the execution is done, a $1,500 check written out by the warden is cashed by Frank
Luchter,
yeah, baby, who had inspected his grandfather's gallows in the week before the execution.
Frank Luchter.
The dude guy, is still a legend.
He is a legend. And that was in 94.
Yeah, that he actually did the inspection and passed everything. I couldn't even believe it when I found it. So if anybody's been listening to the shows, this is our third installment and more likely the fourth installment, and we've had multiple deaths that could be attributed to the work of the Luchter family.
And if you don't understand, he had precise instructions and the way these things had to be built,
yes,
and where the rope had to be behind the left ear and all this stuff, so that way, because in his profession, that when that rope hits a full extension, it snaps mm-hmm. the neck and kills the individual rather than, you know, letting them dangle before they die.
Definitely one of the storied families anywhere in execution. So I thought that was crazy that there was a tie back to all that in the end. So that is the execution of Charles Campbell. So a couple questions for you. How can a 45-year and a 30-year sentence be run concurrently and have the 30-year sentence bylaws be what governs it? I just was perplexed by this whole thing.
This is another issue with the judicial system that we have. How anything like this is even possible. For one, okay, if they can't be stacked on top of each other for 75 years, mm-hmm. at least stagger them.
Right.
Like, okay, you're going to get a full 30 and then then we can talk about chopping up the 45 one. Maybe you're going to get 15 more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something like that, where you get 45 years. That's a fucking long time.
Dude, that's a lifetime, man.
So
if you go in at 18, that's 63.
So I think that if you, especially if you get two sentences.
Yeah.
The first one's got to be fulfilled.
Agreed.
And then the second one, if you want to parse it up to where on good behavior,
yeah,
you can start talking.
Sure. Well, I think that there's no way that they should be able to run like that, period. I think if you get hit with two different things like this, and let's just say that you end up somehow with like two different 25-year or more sentences, and you do, at that point in time, it's lifetime, buddy.
I mean, we've heard of this before.
It's throw away the key time.
Yeah, we've heard of these cases before.
Yeah.
This is the second or third time we've heard of concurrent running sentences.
Right, and it wasn't like this guy was some model prisoner in jail, even though we got time off for good behavior.
Right. Yeah, so, but the good behavior, if you do your research, is because he had friends in the system, or made friends.
Which brings me to the second question. Do you think that Button should have been charged? Now, there have been multiple inmates that have come out with these exact same stories about what his role is and everything, and they have struggled to really tie a lot of things back to him. I mean, you're talking about an era that wasn't all surveillance and craziness, you know what I mean? I'm sure you could run things a little bit more, and if you don't have solid proof, other than the testimony of a convict, you don't have much.
I can tell you right now that Button, this is his situation. Listen, man, you help me out, I'll help you out.
For sure.
I know what your plans are. I know you want to go get your revenge.
Right.
Listen, be patient.
Hmm?
Do your work for me.
Yep.
And I'll get you out. That's it. Simple. The guy's making money.
And for some of them, he was. I mean, I was also partially surprised, though, if this guy's so good at busting skulls and doing what you need him to, why are you letting him out?
He's kind of like your linchpin. You need him.
Right. But I'm sure that he brought other people up through to handle it. And
I didn't mean to throw that pun out there.
No, but
the linchpin.
I get it. I thought maybe at some point, you know, like it shows a reason for the next generation to be loyal. You know, hey, I got Jimmy here out, you know, after 7 years and he was supposed to do 45, you know. You come work for me, the same thing can happen for you, you know?
Yeah, no, it's definitely a...
show them something at the end of the rainbow.
Yeah, it's like, you know.
And I know this is something that we've talked about a little bit on the show. How do you feel about the fact that there are tons of people that are actually on death row in Washington State, but they haven't used it since 2011?
I think that if you're not executing, if this particular state or that particular state are... You've decided not to execute anyone.
Yeah.
You need to get rid of your death row.
I agree completely.
Because it's just a rotting tomatoes.
They kind of try to use it as a scare tactic. Now, one thing that I will say is if you look at the list, the five guys that have been executed, they're all bad men. I mean, they are the worst of the bad men. So in some ways, is Washington State just holding it only for the worst of the worst at that point? Or... I mean, I would have to go through and look at the list and see
what does it have to be? Do you have to kill three people? I mean, what does it have to be? Brutally, three people dead before you're on the death row? And then we may not even kill you?
Yeah.
I think that if you're not going to kill people on a capital punishment.
Yeah.
Now, although the federal is now stepping in on some of these.
Yes, they are.
But let's just say the federal is not. Why would you have a death row option?
I get it.
If you're not going to do it.
That's why I said, I wonder if it's like Kansas where it's just a scare tactic.
Or it's in case somebody else gets elected, now we can start fucking push and go? I mean, I don't know.
I mean, maybe. I don't know. To me, it's just kind of crazy. And then, as always, I think that we're clear on this, but in the end, was justice served in this case?
In the end, was justice served? I say yeah.
I wouldn't have minded if you'd have dangled for a minute, but I respect Frank, so I'm good with what happened.
Well, don't get me wrong. A dangle would have been good in this situation.
That's right. Of course, you know that Charles obviously had some demons in his life. If you or anybody that you love is struggling with mental issues, if you're struggling to cope with things that are going on in the world right now, if you are having a hard time with substance abuse, physical abuse, anything like that, please call 1-800-622-4357. That's the National Mental Health Hotline. Somebody on the other end of the line will be there to help you.
Absolutely. If you're having bad thoughts about hurting yourself or somebody else, or just can't kick that chemical dependency, please call the number.
Thank you guys so much for joining us tonight. We look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Stay safe.